And now, here are your hosts of Lab Radio, sponsored by Coinstructive.
This is Aaron Mungle. I'm here at Inside Bitcoins in San Diego 2015, and I'm here with Spencer Bogart. He's an equity research associate at Needham & Company, which is based out of New York City, but he is based out of San Francisco. So thanks for joining us, Spencer. Thanks for being on our show.
Thanks, Aaron.
And happy to have you here. So yeah, let's start by, you know, we were chatting a little bit about the company you work with and the kind of work you do. It's a very interesting industry because, as we discussed, it's historically been a little bit conservative. So tell us about your work and just, yeah, how everything you do and the industry itself.
Yeah, absolutely. So I work with Needham & Company, which is an investment bank. We're a growth-focused investment bank, and there's kind of three main departments. There's the actual investment banking department, there's the research department, and there's the sales and trading. I work on the research side. And I've historically covered cloud software companies, so companies like Salesforce and NetSuite. And so that means, you know, covering their earnings, kind of covering industry developments, you know, identifying traction with their new products and things like that. And then, you know, have recently been able to channel some of those efforts more towards the blockchain and Bitcoin space.
So that sounds like a really rich subject matter. You were already studying tech, so you were already very tuned into sort of the that world, you know. And would just to kind of like, before we get into Bitcoin and the blockchain, would you say that you've seen that cloud technology and infrastructure related to the blockchain at all? Because I mean, mm-hmm. to some degree, it's kind of enabling decentralization. I was actually thinking about this the other day. Can you comment on that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think that certainly it's an enabler of decentralization, but it's also interesting just in the history of cloud computing. If we look back and think about what major incumbents did with cloud computing, it's kind of similar to what we see them doing right now with blockchain technology, right? So in the early days of cloud computing, right, like most major enterprises said, like, no way, I'm not going to put my stuff in the cloud, right? I'm not going to put my data in the cloud. I'm not going to put any of my operations in the cloud. It's not secure, number of drawbacks. And some of them were true in the early days, right? And then cloud computing really scaled up. And now, like, when we think about, I mean, at least for us, when we're looking at companies, you know, we regularly identify them as pure multi-tenant SaaS, meaning that they're fully cloud companies. And what we originally saw was one first, you know, large incumbents, legacy incumbents, avoid the technology altogether, and then they started doing private clouds, which is like kind of a halfway step, and then kind of doing hybrid cloud strategies in between. So in general, the point just being that this kind of a disruptive technology, the last time when cloud computing came about, we saw large legacy incumbents halfway embrace it. Right now, I think that we're kind of seeing some halfway adoption right now in some legacy incumbents with innovation centers and things like this that may or may not produce actual real use cases in the organization.
Now, do you think that same sort of adoption pattern will happen with blockchain in the same way, like that there's going to be sort of this reticence initially, like, no, we don't want that, and then all of a sudden they're going to say, oh my God, how could we live without this?
I think so. I think it'll very much follow like that, and I think that the ones who don't do that will be left behind. So I think it'll be very much a you'll embrace it or you won't be competitive. And I do think it'll be a little bit of a tepid adoption of the pace.
Absolutely. Yeah. So before we get a little more into sort of this equity and investor sort of mindset, and like maybe you can talk about that historically a little bit, but before we get into that, what is your definition of the blockchain?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the blockchain, if we're talking about the blockchain,
right,
like then we must be going to the Bitcoin blockchain. And if that's the case, I'd say it's the trust layer for the internet. And if we're just saying a blockchain, well, it's a distributed ledger of some sort. It could be very well distributed. It could be poorly distributed. Mm-hmm. And it could have varying degrees of security. But overall, I'd say that the best way to sum up the blockchain would be a trust layer for the internet.
Nice. I like that. And how about Bitcoin? What would your definition be of Bitcoin?
That's a good one. You know, it's not it's not too often I step back to ask myself that question,
right?
What is Bitcoin? But but it's a good question. I'd say it's the world's first distributed currency.
I like that. World's first
distributed decentralized currency.
What gets you the most excited about this technology? You know, blockchain, Bitcoin, whatever you want to speak to.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the most exciting thing about it really is that it's empowering for individuals, right? So it allows people to fully be in control of money, to be their own bank, to take control of one of the most important aspects of their life, and I think that's really empowering. So I think that's one part of it, and then the other part is just that it's going to enable new possibilities, right? So once you have direct peer-to-peer value exchange around the world, I mean, I think that, that Bitcoin is only the first stage of that, and that we have a lot more to go.
Got it. Let's talk about your, bread and butter and field. Before you tell us about specifically kind of the work you do, how did you get into this field? Like, what was your foray? I mean, did you start off with like something else and then kind of got into like more of the research side? Or yeah, tell us about this sort of pathway you took.
Yeah, absolutely. So before my current role, I was an ETF analyst working with exchange-traded funds. And we're talking about things like gold, which like one of the main tickers there for a gold ETF would be GLD. And anyways, one of these conversations kind of digressed into talking about Silk Road, and inevitably Bitcoin came up. And this was very early days, and I had never heard of it. A couple people in the room mentioned it. I think this was probably very early 2013. And then from there, it's straight down the rabbit hole. Once you find that thread and you start pulling on it, you know, it becomes almost irresistible. And so it's kind of been one of those passion projects for a long time that now I've been able to blend in professionally, which is a nice thing to have.
That's really awesome. A lot of people are kind of more siloed, so they don't get that luxury. But I guess now, is research sort of different now, like the way you're doing it compared to that world and the ETF stuff? Was that more like, was it more connected with sort of almost like a trading angle, or was it more research angle?
Well, I'd say it's a little bit different because just in the ETF world, the idea is that you're not going to try to pick specific companies to try and outperform in the stock market. The idea is you're going to take a diversified basket and try and earn market returns. And this comes from a lot of academic research that basically shows that like investor psychology is awful and it works against you like in a number of ways, and really trying to pick winners ultimately ends up being expensive, and you end up worse off than if you'd just taken a market weighted basket and called it a day, and you actually end up pretty well. So the main difference in shifting to kind of a Bitcoin or blockchain space is that you're shifting from kind of important macro drivers, which would drive the ETF world. So like, what is the Federal Reserve going to do? Like, what's going on in Japan right now? To very much more microeconomic drivers. So what's going on specifically that's driving some of these Bitcoin or blockchain companies towards adoption? And inevitably those two worlds do tie in, but I prefer actually being a little bit more focused on the micro side of this specific industry.
And in what ways are you doing that?
Yeah, so I wrote what I believe is Wall Street's first comprehensive industry report on the blockchain industry.
Neat.
So that was a long time coming, and it was many months of research and many months of talking to the companies in the space, talking to venture capitalists in the space. And so that was kind of Needham's first foray into the space, and it was extremely well received. So now I think that we're looking to dig a little bit deeper into the area and follow up with a few more interesting reports in 2016.
And you guys generally release that information for free as sort of like you're sort of this advisory thought leader to the industry in different capacities?
Yeah, absolutely. So our normal clientele base would be large buy-side investors. So these are like mutual funds and hedge funds and things like that. So those are usually the people that receive it. So for people that are listening from the Bitcoin world, it's good because, you know, it's starting to permeate kind of the idea of Bitcoin and blockchain through institutional investors, which would be an important community to help get on board. As much as, you know, a lot of the spirit is to disrupt the legacy financial institutions, certainly there's a lot of investment capital to be had in those institutions. So being able to channel that towards Bitcoin and blockchain would be highly productive for the industry overall.
Perfect foray into like sort of that general attitude and sort of just sort of risk tolerance of that crowd equity and investment world. You mentioned academic research, so are they just kind of clinging to this sort of model that they feel like is proven, and like they could maybe in some way they're getting these metrics they want, and then compare that to Bitcoin, and why are they sort of like scared or nervous or unsure compared to like what they're already doing? Like what's the gap there, or what's the, you know,
I think the one of the things that scares people, and one, we need to differentiate between using Bitcoin operationally for a large financial institution and investing in the space.
Got it.
Right? So I think that generally large financial institutions, ones that are doing investing, the kind of risk that they want to hold is the kind of investment risks. They don't really want operational risk. And so something that's new that could have benefits but they're not certain of, like Bitcoin, is hard to adopt operationally and easier right now, more where the industry's focus is on, is should I be investing in the space? And I think that that's a natural first step. I mean, by the time some of these companies are actually operationally, Bitcoin is operationally inside some of the companies, I mean, some of the opportunity will have passed already, right? Like once you have major FIs adopting Bitcoin or blockchain or whatever it is to conduct their business, you already missed the ground level adoption.
Right. So you're saying there's going to be more of a basically investing in companies directly for some specific product or service that they have a better understanding of versus Bitcoin as a currency. And to your point, that's one application of blockchain and Bitcoin technology, happens to be currency. So that's another distinction that's probably good to make. So like that's there's some good points. Like Bitcoin itself investing in it, but then the companies in the space, that's almost VC thinking.
Yeah, and some of the FIs have already taken on some strategic investments like Visa and MasterCard, and some of these guys are already out there with, you know, not insignificant investments in blockchain related companies so that they can, you know, start to become more familiar with the technology and be able to look with a more long-term view about how would we implement this internally.
Now one thing I probably should have teased apart a little more was you mentioned writing that report on, you said was the first sort of industry report on, did you say blockchain companies?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what were some of the insights you gained from that? Just open up sort of a little bit of a summary or something.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So a few things. I mean, mainly I chose to get out there and write this report just from interacting a lot around specifically the San Francisco Bay Area, around a lot of the developer community and a lot of Bitcoin enthusiasts, and finding out that everyone was really excited about the technology, blockchain and Bitcoin. I'm not really into the whole false dichotomy of Bitcoin or blockchain. I think they're inevitably interrelated.
Sure.
And I think a discussion around blockchain is positive for Bitcoin.
Some people try to keep it in a vacuum, you're saying?
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like, what's the point? It's all intertwined.
It's a false dichotomy in my view. But so I started to realize that while there was tremendous potential for this technology, that a lot of what people were talking about just really didn't make sense. So some of the applications, like when you delved in, you start talking to people in the industry, you start talking about the real advantages, and you start to realize that, look, blockchain's a great thing, but it doesn't improve anything here. And I don't want to get into too many specifics there, because some of the companies are still out there and operational, and they could, I could be wrong.
Sure.
Right? And maybe they really do have a great use case that we haven't seen yet.
Mm.
But overall, I'd say that a quick summary of it. So, I mean, the title is The Blockchain Report, Welcome to the Internet of Value. So I think that starts to get an idea of how important we think the blockchain could be in longer term. So, I mean, I think that the quote was that we think that the disruptive impact could be, you know, on par with the internet. So, I mean, that's a very high bar to set right away. And overall, when we look out at this world, you know, we certainly see that open, permissionless public blockchains will play a huge role in terms of innovation moving forward. And that's not to say that private permission blockchains don't have a role. It's just that they're a little bit unproven at this point.
Got it. Do you have any insight on, I read this article about, it had a list of 10 major banks that were developing sort of their own, I don't know if I'm saying this right, but I don't know if they're developing their own blockchain or they're just taking the blockchain tech and sort of breaking it down and like trying different configurations. I don't know if you have a further clarity on that, but it seems like there's this reticence to invest in it, but then you have this other side where they're like going all in on sort of this black box R&D that they're not really talking about, but you know that they're doing it because of these articles. But
So I think that the consortium that you're referring to is called R3, and they've got a lot more banks on now. They've got like 35 banks on now. It includes most of the heavy hitters around the world. So they've certainly been able to draw a lot of attention from their ability to bring in the biggest banks to also down the table and say, let's agree to a common standard for blockchain so that we can all operate between each other and we can leverage this technology, we can get the efficiency. in a way that also makes sense for our business lines, right? So the huge challenge there is really around KYC and AML stuff, so know your customer and anti-money laundering rules. And the Bitcoin blockchain is not necessarily incredibly well built for that. In fact, mm-hmm. it's designed to avoid a lot of that in terms of being pseudonymous. And so whether or not, you know, pooling together 30 banks to come to a common standard will be a fruitful process is yet to be seen. I mean, on the one hand, you have to think that having, you know, 35 huge banks in a room together trying to agree on one thing is overly challenging and perhaps won't work out. But on the other hand, if they do come to a standard, I mean, that's a lot of weight to throw behind one stable architecture mm-hmm. that people can build around. So
this reminds me of the Glidera talking points where he was saying, look at Amazon as an e-commerce sort of, you know, common universal sort of option. And then he also said same thing with Google, and I would argue also Facebook, like with the social logins. So there's something to be said about having these central logins. Yes, there's the issue of like the centralization, but at the end of the day, these institutions are there, so they need to be sort of configured and put together. And so that's what it sounds like that discussion is. Now, I didn't realize it was actually a official concerted effort to do so. Now, who initiated that? Was that internal members of the community?
Like, no, so it's actually it's its own company called R3, and to help, I think, partially, one, to help generate a bit of revenue for themselves, but also to help get the banks to be, to help push them forward with it. They charge like a monthly or a yearly fee to be a part of this consortium.
Interesting. So it's like sort of banking-specific consulting.
It is.
That's pretty smart, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I keep thinking like managing assets and stuff. I've heard talk of how that actually would make their lives better. So they might actually, like, night and day, reactions, like, given enough time for them to really see the benefits, it seems like eventually someone's going to start coming around, if not already. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're going to just quietly build their, like, golden goose that lays the golden egg. Because, I mean, that's the thing. I feel like when there's a big opportunity, it gets really quiet, like mining.
Yeah.
It gets super quiet. Like, there's all these mining companies, and I'm like, I know you guys are doing something crazy. I don't know what. But so anyway, let's see. So that's really interesting stuff. I mean, did you have any other points on all that before I jumped into sort of some other industry thoughts and questions?
No, we can jump right into some industry stuff.
Okay, since we are talking sort of enterprise level scale, big scale, and institutional investors are almost a different mindset, or not necessarily mindset, but different day-to-day activities than the average sort of entrepreneur just running a business.
Yeah.
But I am curious, you know, and you're feel free to, if you want to speak to small businesses or enterprises, whatever you feel like you could speak best to, what would you say are the biggest opportunities for, like, businesses and organizations using this technology such as the blockchain, and why?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think that certainly in the financial space, there's just tremendous opportunity. I mean, most of what the financial industry does is serve as an intermediary. And, you know, I mean, a lot of times when you interact within the Bitcoin world, you know, intermediaries are held up as the worst thing in the world. They're not the worst thing in the world. Intermediaries are there because they perform a valuable role.
Mm-hmm.
The only question is whether or not now the technology that we have helps diminish the need for some of that function, and whether or not we can replace some of that with technology. And so a lot of what major financial institutions do, a lot of that could be done with a blockchain. That doesn't mean that those intermediaries necessarily all go away or disappear. Some of them might, but it overall makes them more efficient, and overall that puts more money back in the hands of the people that are transacting and engaging in it, and back to more productive resources. So instead of just making a transaction happen, I can actually put that money towards payroll and growth, right? So overall, I think it'll be positive for enterprise businesses like large financial institutions, and also very positive for small and medium-sized businesses that will benefit in terms of being able to engage in online commerce in a more frictionless manner.
That reminds me of, I think it was in New York City, there was like a hot dog stand, or, you know, maybe not hot dog, but like the sort of media stand, and I think he may have sold, you know, kind of like a general store on wheels or something. And his explanation was just so simple. He was like, I love it. I get my money right away. It's instant. I was like, wow. See, he just broke down. Like, we get caught up in all the minutiae, which is great, mm-hmm. you know, because there's a lot of discussion to be had there. But this guy's just like, yep, I got my money. It's like debit as a default. I don't know if anyone's said that term a lot.
It's almost like just getting cash for it.
Yeah.
right? Because there's no way that the transaction can be reversed.
Sure.
Nobody's going to charge them a fee on it, right? So for merchants, it's actually like there's a ton of reason to accept Bitcoin.
Yeah.
The big challenge there has just been that there aren't that many people trying to pay in Bitcoin.
Exactly.
Because most people are holding that there aren't really spending it, and so the transactional volume is relatively light. I mean, we do see it on the blockchain, right? That transactional volume is ticking up, but a lot of it's, you know, buying and selling back between investors that are holding it.
Exactly. So let's say you could wave a magic wand. What would you change about the industry? You know.
Yeah. It would definitely be around regulatory clarity. So at a minimum, just understanding what's inbounds and what's not. And, you know, I mean, a lot of times I think the regulators are vilified here. And some of that's fair and some of it isn't. I mean, I think they're genuinely good people in there that are trying to do the right thing. And unfortunately, they're stuck right now with regulation that doesn't fit the mold of what blockchain and Bitcoin does. And so it leaves a ton of gray area, and companies that are out there, that's an operational cost that they incur either directly or indirectly when you're trying to start a company and you're not sure about whether or not you're doing something legally or illegally.
So there's that discretion that's up to them, almost like an inspector. Yeah. It's like, what do they choose to nitpick on, right?
Exactly, exactly. And so at least, at the bare minimum, if I had my magic wand, I'd like to see at least very clear definitions of what's okay and what isn't, so the businesses can move forward with confidence. Now, if my wand was really magically powerful, you know, I'd like to prefer a really completely hands-off approach, right? So that we could, I mean, most new technologies from a regulatory perspective have been given some time to kind of grow before they've really drawn heavier regulation. PayPal got this in its early days. And I'd hope to see something similar here from Bitcoin to blockchain. I mean, it's just, it's a huge opportunity that's really good for people overall. And so it'd be a shame to see, you know, fear drive it away.
Right. And I think that's an interesting outcome of sort of all these different reactions happening all over the world. And it's pretty clear that certain ones are like kind of vilified, like the New York Bit license approach, or like the I heard in New Hampshire they were doing something similar, which seems crazy. I'm like, I thought that was the free state, so yeah. I was very confused by that. But that's a very cautionary sort of tale. I there was a Andreas Antonopoulos spoke with the Canadian Parliament, I believe. They were so open, and it was like, wow, this is like a great model of just how to react to this discussion.
Right.
Let's have a discussion.
Right.
Oh, great, that's a great start. So I thought that was wonderful. What would be some, obviously, read your report, and we'll have you say the title again, but what are some resources and materials that, you know, let's say someone wants to look at it from a research side, maybe you're a business owner, maybe you're a fellow, you know, investor, like what are some resources to look into as a starting point that are pretty thorough and robust?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the natural first place to start, and I'm sure that most people would say this, would be the Satoshi white paper.
Of course.
And then, you know, I think that if you're just looking for kind of those one-on-one stuff, I think that Bitcoin.org does a good job with their educational resources.
Okay.
And then I'd say from there, you kind of, there's a lot of different spaces to delve into in the kind of Bitcoin blockchain space. And I'd say then the best thing to do is to use your Googling skills to get out there and really, really dive down the rabbit hole of whatever it is that you really want to know. And probably reach out to some of the businesses out there. In general, I find that people are pretty receptive. And so, you know, if you're trying to build something out there, you just want to learn a little bit more about it, you know, reach out to somebody at one of the companies that's operating. I mean, they spend, you know, a good 60 hours a week probably working in that one space, just understanding the challenges of it. So, you know, you can try and recreate that and do all of your own online research, or, you know, if you can find a resource at one of those companies that might be willing to share a little bit of that insight, that's a helpful way.
Yeah, any other sort of resources that are must have? I guess mention your paper again.
Yeah. The title. So you can check out, I think if you Google around, it's out there. I mean, I think that we don't make it available. If you Google around, you're able to find it. The title is The Blockchain Report, Welcome to the Internet of Value.
Awesome. And so how do we get in touch with you if anyone wants to learn more about what you're doing with your company or listen to more of your, follow you? You know, I'm sure you post cool stuff and put out reports.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've actually mostly cut off from Twitter. So, but nice. You can still find me on there at, my handle's Milton von Mises.
Okay.
A little bit of a throwback to Ludwig von Mises and Milton Friedman. So
awesome.
A little bit of a hybrid there. Regulatory environment in the investment banking world makes me extremely hesitant to ever use it anymore, just because if you properly disseminate the wrong type of information without the proper disclosures can be an issue.
Mm.
So it just makes me pretty hesitant. So I'm not on there very much, but
occasionally
I might go in there
to
post a link, and otherwise, you know, LinkedIn or reach out through a mutual contact.
Great, yeah.
Awesome.
But yeah, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
This is good.